Hello and welcome to volume 144 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll learn about the role that forest owners played in getting a bill passed in Washington State. We'll hear more about chronic wasting disease in deer, and we'll do a little tax planning, and we'll discuss the carbon offset market. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Mark Dale is a forestry consultant who's also a real estate broker and an appraiser. He's taken time to become familiar with the Natural Capital Exchange, which is a marketplace for those who wish to defer harvests of timber in exchange for money paid by corporations who wish to be seen as carbon neutral. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Hayes.
Mark, take us through this exchange, what it is, and how it works.
Well, thank you, Hayes. The Natural Capital Exchange is a remote sensing-enabled marketplace that links buyers and sellers of forest carbon, and in which landowners in the U.S. are getting paid to defer timber harvest for 1 year. Now, you may be familiar with some of the previous carbon programs that kind of came out of California, and they had very long time periods, 10-year contracts, 15, in some cases up to 100-year contracts, which really aren't feasible for the private landowner. This new exchange is only for 1 year. And now the stated goal of the program is to increase carbon stored in the private forest by paying landowners to defer business-as-usual timber harvest. Now, this program is based on the Harvest Deferment Credit, which can be thought of as the additional carbon stored measured in tons as a result of deferring the harvest over a one-year term. Now, that gets into the question is, how are these harvest deferment credits determined? Well, their assessments run using satellite imagery and other remote sensing technologies to determine the likelihood of harvest across a landowner's properties. And the good thing about this assessment is it's a free, no-obligation assessment that is performed on their property, so it doesn't cost the landowner anything. And after the assessment, they'll be assigned the number of harvest deferment credits that they're eligible to sell on the Natural Capital Exchange. Now, the number of harvest deferment credits that will be enabled by the age and the size of your timber. So take, for instance, a landowner that has a three-year-old stand of planted loblolly pine. Well, I haven't seen too many instances where anyone's wanting to harvest some three-year-olds. So you would likely not receive many harvest deferment credits on young stands. But if you have larger, older stands, these would generate a good share of harvest deferment credits. And with the low timber prices that we're seeing in some areas of the South, and we're seeing landowners delay harvest, this is another option for earning some income.
So it's a delay over business as usual harvest, right? So there is a baseline that you need to show. What is the? Everybody, I'm sure people are interested in what the fee or price of these credits are per acre.
Well, you know, that old question. That question is the answer is it depends, and I know no one wants to hear that kind of answer. Because it's due to the many factors that determine the harvest risk on a property, things like rotation age, past harvest activity, or even the local timber economics. So it's difficult to provide an accurate estimate for the payments a landowner could expect to receive in the program until they have the assessment done. But I can give you some numbers that from the first round, which was the spring round, and it was the very first one that was available to landowners, and some of my
spring
landowners.
Spring 2021, yeah. We're talking about, right? Okay.
Yes, that was the NCA, the Natural Capital Exchange cycle 2021B. And on the low end, I'll give you a range. Landowners received some just over $2 an acre, which they had a lot of young timber, up to almost $14 an acre. And that's with the carbon price that sold at $17 a ton. Now, I know no one's
per risk. Per year, right? That's a one-year commitment,
it's a
right?
one-year okay. one-year commitment. And you can tell nobody's getting rich from this, but, you know, most landowners are able to cover their taxes and maybe buy the grandkids some Christmas gifts, or even take mama out for a steak dinner. But in this, and you got to remember that first round, they were only looking at pine. You know, it was pretty experimental. They weren't including any hardwood acres. Well, the second round that actually just closed yesterday, they included hardwood and pine in the calculations, and we're seeing a 40% increase in my landowners in the number of credits that they were able to generate per eligible acre.
Let's go over real quick. Do you see any downsides or other issues that landowners could face?
Well, you know, you are signing a contract that you're going to reduce your timber harvest over the next year. So if you see a sudden price spike in a particular product that you have on your property, you wouldn't be able to take advantage of that. And then also, you know, people ask about thinnings. I have stuff already scheduled. You would need to, you can take account for thinnings by reducing the number of harvest deferment credits you offer to sell. So you can kind of play that a little bit. And then also you might have natural disasters, which would reduce your carbon stocks. And, you know, those things happen, and you would get a reduced payment just based on, you know, how much damage was done.
And you're paid at the end, though, right, at the end of the term?
Yeah, it's paid at the end of the term.
Got to actually do it. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mark. Appreciate that very concise and helpful description. We thank you very much.
Okay.
In 2009, the state of Washington passed a Right to Farm Act, and that protected landowners from nuisance lawsuits. The Washington Forest Protection Association saw that some improvements were needed and played a major role in getting the bill modified. And we have Jason Callahan, the Director of Government Relations for the Association, with us. Welcome, Jason.
Good morning.
What technical issue did your association see that was missing that needed improvement?
Yeah, well, in 2009, like you said, the legislature passed the Right to Farm Act, which said pretty much you can't move next to a farm and then sue a farm for being a farm. A few years after that, we had that law changed, and we had it added forestry. So you can't move next to a working forest and sue a working forest just because it's a working forest. The problem was in 2009 when they did the Right to Farm Act, they also added a mandatory real estate disclosure statement. So anybody who bought a house in Washington was identified as the fact that if you're moving next to a farm, you can't sue the farm in a nuisance lawsuit. When the law was changed to add forestry, they never went back and changed that real estate disclosure. So you had a law that protect farms and forests and a real estate disclosure that only spoke to farms. So the last step in our process of getting this equal protection for forestry with agriculture was to have that real estate disclosure statement changed so that people, anybody buying a house in Washington, was also aware that the right to farm includes the right to forestry. So it was sort of the three steps to get to where we needed to be.
Okay. What are the broader societal issues that are at stake in something like this?
Well, right now, Washington's a bit of a boom state. I think we're one of the fastest growing states in the nation. And that means we have people moving out of urban Washington and into rural Washington. And we also have a lot of out-of-state immigration into Washington. And often those people are moving in the areas that are traditionally the home of our working forest, our rural areas where forestry is the culture, it's the history, it's the economy of the area. But they don't necessarily have that same appreciation when they get to the rural areas. And so we were able to have this real estate disclosure added. So at least someone moving into an area of traditional working forest are aware of the culture they're moving into and the legal rights that protect their new neighbors. And it also creates the opportunities for our forest landowners to start that conversation with new neighbors moving into the rural area and say, did you see the real estate disclosure? Have the conversation with the local realtors and just have that first introduction to their new neighbors to make sure the transition into our rural areas is a little more seamless. And interestingly enough, when the Right to Farm bill was passed, the realtors were concerned of having different real estate disclosures in different parts of the state. So it's actually a statewide real estate disclosure. So if someone moves to Seattle, even, you know, right where there's no working forest, moves into downtown Seattle, whether it's from Texas or California or Arizona or these other common source states for our population change. They, at least on some subconscious level, when they buy their townhouse in the middle of Seattle, see that statement about working for us on the real estate disclosures, and it hopefully just gives them a little bit of insight and a little bit of a mindset of the state they're moving into, which they may not appreciate coming from a place like Arizona or California.
So the realtors were important to be at the table when this went down?
You know, so as you lesson learns as you go through legislative processes, the realtors, which is not a group forest landowners work with very often, at least in the legislative arena, you know, they had a series of years of legislature with making them change their real estate disclosure form. So they print out all these forms, and then they got to go reprint them again. And so what they asked was, we could be part of their own pilot project, which is asking the legislature to collect them over a course of 2 or 3 years, put the late effective dates on it, so they can just do one big change twice a decade, three times a decade, instead of every year. And so, happy to work with them. They ended up being happy to work with us. But that was the one stakeholder you had to make sure was comfortable, because they're the ones who actually had to do something when the bill was enacted, which was change the actual documents they have their seller signing.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jason. We appreciate that information. Very interesting. I appreciate you being part of our program.
All right. Thank you.
Deer hunting is a big deal in Alabama and draws many conservation-minded people outdoors every fall and winter. One of the threats to the sport is chronic wasting disease, and our next guest, Ben Westfall, with the National Deer Association, can help us learn more. Hello, Ben.
Good morning.
What is CWD, and why is it such a potential problem to Alabama deer hunters?
So chronic wasting disease is a contagious neurological disease that affects members of the deer family. Some of the symptoms include degeneration of the brain, hence the wasting aspect, resulting in emaciation, abnormal behavior, loss of bodily functions, and ultimately death. CWD is always fatal, and as of now, there is no cure or vaccine. And in North America alone, CWD is present in 26 states and 3 Canadian provinces. And the reason CWD is a big deal to Alabama landowners and hunters is due in part to how easily it spreads through a deer population. It can spread through a variety of vectors, including urine, feces, saliva, blood, disposed deer parts, and between live deer, and it is extremely difficult to eradicate once established in a population.
Okay. Despite how contagious this is CWD in Alabama, and how would you recognize it in a deer if you were curious about it?
So currently, to date, there have been no positive CWD cases in the state of Alabama. But Mississippi and Tennessee both have multiple confirmed cases of CWD in wild populations right along the Alabama border. So if found in Alabama, there could be drastic changes in rules and regulations that will directly affect how we manage and hunt our deer populations here in Alabama. How do we know if a deer has it? A lot of times deer are asymptomatic, and it can take up to 18 months before a deer will actually display physical symptoms. But the way that we know if a deer has it is we simply test for it. And currently there are three primary testing methods that are used. The first is called an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, or ELISA for short, which is considered the gold standard in CWD testing. But ELISA can only test postmortem tissue, meaning that the lymph nodes or brain and spinal tissue must be removed from dead deer only. And the immunosorbent assay aspect of that means that the antigen is immobilized on a solid surface like an auger plate, and then complex with an antibody to detect the presence of soluble substances, and in this case, that would be misfolded proteins. The second testing method is called immunohistochemistry, or IHC, and similar to ELISA, IHC is the process of selectively identifying proteins in cells of tissue by exploiting the principal antibodies, and again, this method can only be used on dead deer. And lastly, one of the newer and more promising methods is called real-time quaking-induced conversion, or RT-QIC. And this method is a little bit different and involves placing suspended samples from either live or dead deer in a solution, shaking and incubating the mixture to get a reaction, and then monitoring for the growth of those misfolded prions that cause CWD.
This sounds like it's done in a lab, not on the field, right? So,
yes, sir.
Yeah. All right. There's research out there. Is there any we should know about?
Yes, so there have been some encouraging new developments with the RT-QIC testing method. As you mentioned, those previous methods can only be done so in the lab, but that may not be the case for much longer. In April of 2021, infectious disease scientists at the National Institutes of Health discovered that a half a centimeter hole punch from the ears of asymptomatic whitetail and mule deer had similar or better diagnostic sensitivity and specificity of identifying CWD compared to the ELISA method. So rather than having to remove the lymph nodes or brain and spinal tissue from a dead deer, scientists have been able to collect skin tissue from the ears of live deer and obtain accurate diagnostic results in about 9 hours. I'll wrap up by saying RT-QuIC is currently only used for research and is not yet validated for official regulatory disease testing in wild or captive deer. But if proven, experts may have discovered a way to test live or dead deer and get accurate results even more quickly than we've realized. So it's very promising that hopefully one day soon scientists may be able to develop a field testing kit for hunters to take with them on hunting trips to receive accurate results in just hours, which has significant implications for the future of CWD research and for the safety of hunters who intend to consume or donate their venison.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ben. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you for having me.
The U.S. tax code and its regulations are full of legal terms and jargon that are used to determine how laws apply to a particular activity. It usually takes a specialist to unlock the meaning of these terms, and Orman Wilson is such a person. Hello, Orman.
Good morning.
Qualified timber property is one of those legal jargon terms. What does that mean?
Okay, it's not, the requirements are not that stringent. It just has to be at least a 1 acre. It's got to be located in the United States, and the timber must be planted, cultivated, and sold for commercial purposes.
Okay, so an active growing forest used for commercial purposes in the U.S. That's not too difficult. What about reforestation expenses? What are considered proper reforestation expenses under the code?
Okay, this is one of the most misunderstood terms in timber taxation. A lot of CPAs and accountants don't understand it, but it's pretty simple as well. Any cost to prep a site, the seeds, the seedlings, any labor and tools are deductible, and also you can even depreciate the equipment that's used to reforest land.
Okay. What about preparing the site for the seeds? Is that also a reforestation expense?
Yes. Any cost, you may have to put a road in, culvert, whatever. Those expenses mm-hmm. are also deductible.
Okay. Spraying?
Spraying? Yes.
Okay, good. Is there any special tax reason for having a written forest management plan? You know, most people think it's probably a good idea to have something like that, but what about from a tax standpoint?
Yes, we always advise our timberland owners to have a management plan. They can get with their foresters and come up with a plan. It lets the IRS know that you actually have a motive for your a profit motive for your mm-hmm. timberland, and you're allowed to treat. You may not have a sale every year, but if you're in the timber business, you get to deduct these expenses, where if you're just an investor, then those expenses would probably go on Schedule A and could very well be limited.
It goes back to that qualified timber property concept that this is a commercial venture, right? You have one reason being you have a management plan, right? Yeah.
Yes, okay. And since 2008, you can deduct up to $10,000 per qualified timber property. So it does add up.
All right. Well, thanks, Orman. We appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Mark Dale, Jason Callahan, Ben Westfall, and Orman Wilson. Have you been to the lumber aisle at Lowe's or Home Depot lately? If so, you know that lumber prices are at a 25-year high, but at the same time, you also know that stumpage prices are lower than they were 25 years ago. This has never happened before. How did we get here? The U.S. South has long bragged that it was the wood basket of the world. We bragged about our favorable growing season, our adaptation to new technologies, and our mills that were capable of processing our products to be used worldwide. And apparently, we've done a pretty good job of building an inventory of standing timber. But supply and demand can be a vicious thing if you get on the wrong side of it. The good thing is that nothing stays the same forever. So maintain a diverse product mix, exercise patience and control, and utilize the professionals who can guide you through the rocky shores. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.